August 18th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting live from the festival on Saturday from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next on KBOO on Words and Pictures, SW Concerts speaks with Matt Boers, founders of the NIB. Based in Portland, the NIB is a publisher of political comments and graphic journalism. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Dark Side Cinema, open every night and featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes is available online at darksidecinema.com.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm joined in the studio by two of the leading lights in comics journalism. They hail from continents on opposite sides of the globe, but they've come together here in Portland to publish some of the most politically aware cartoons of our time. Matt Boers is a frequent guest on Words and Pictures. His voice, his work has appeared in The Nation, The Daily Beast, and The Village Voice. And he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in editorial cartooning back in 2012. He is now the editor of Nib Magazine. Matt, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hey, what's up? Thanks for having me.
And across from me here, Larry Harris has served as the deputy editor of the Nib. She's been published by the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, Narratively, and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Originally from Tasmania, she now makes her home in Portland. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you.
All right, so the Nib magazine, it's been around since 2013, and it's named after an analog artist's tool, someone that's still being used by many comics artists like you, Larry, those who've maybe put off buying a graphics tablet. Tell us about the Nib. It's online. It's also in print. You're doing physical media. You've got a lot of people working with you.
Yeah, the Nib's been around since 2013. I founded it on Medium, which is a online publishing platform. And the magazine itself has only been around for a year. So we just put out our fourth issue, the Scams issue, just this month. And before that, we were just publishing online. So we mostly publish political cartoons, nonfiction stuff, daily, you know, everything from what's going on with Trump to memoir and journalism that relates to everything going on in the world. And then the print magazine is sort of focuses on issues that are not exactly news cycle related. So they're themed around the four that we've done are death, family, empire, and scams. So they have a longer shelf life than, you know, a daily newsletter with a comic about whatever it was that Trump did yesterday.
So you are a founder, you're the editor, you're the owner now of the Nib.
Yeah.
it's gone through a couple of platforms. It's gone through the Medium, and more recently First Look Media came along, and now you've been set loose. You're kind of, yeah, it's interesting. You've been a comics artist for a very long time.
Sure.
But and then you were one time that you came on the show, you had just come back from Afghanistan. You were quite the globetrotter for a while, and that you joined Ted Rall on a trek through war zones that was not necessarily authorized by any particular government or State Department. But now you're a dad. That's you're settled down. But it seems like you've got a child at home, you got a child on the way, and you've got a child in the Nib now.
Yeah, the lifespan of the Nib so far has been tumultuous at some points, and you know, we've had multiple near-death experiences with, you know, first we were with Medium, Larry and Matt Lubchansky, another editor. We all worked at Medium, and they kind of pulled funding, I guess it was 2015, and you know, I took the nib with me and eventually hooked up with First Look Media, and then we relaunched real shortly after that, like the beginning of 2016, and we ended up doing a lot of stuff there and really grew.
We did an animation series. We did two animation series. I would like to point out, Matt, though, that the magazine is not your first print baby, because we did have an Eisner-nominated anthology called Eat More Comics that came out between Medium and First Look Media.
Oh yeah,
which is a big, beautiful book that still exists.
Yeah, we've done a lot of stuff. It's kind of hard to even remember it all. We
Eat More Comics, the best of the nib that's still available?
Yes, that collection, Eat More Comics, is still available. That's basically the best of the nib from, I guess we could
the
call
early
it,
years.
Yeah, nib 1.0. And then, you know, nib 2.0, which is like the last 3.5 years, doesn't have a best of collection, although...
Yet.
Yeah, I'm going to do some... something.
Well, I think our listeners might be most familiar with First Look Media because of their investigative journalism arm, The Intercept, which features work by Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Jeremy Scahill. And they, you know, it got a boost from billionaire eBay founder Pierre Omidyar. He was the founder of not just, First Look Media had not just the nib on board, but it also had topic.com on board, and they were the ones who produced the animated versions of the nib, and you had some really amazing animators working.
Yeah, that was really fun. So Topic is like a, it describes itself as like a visual storytelling platform, so they have a lot of, they have some like regular articles and essays, but they have like photo essays, video, short form doc, fiction, video, and then they got into some animation with us, which was a lot of fun to do. I mean, we kind of got to play around with Augenblick Studios, who's like a super high-end animation studio in New York that does Cartoon Network stuff. And, you know, they did most of the real work of making all of us.
We just
stuff
did
move.
Storyboards.
Yeah.
But Matt did get to make the ultimate animation, which was the P-tape.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Back a few... if you recall the P-tape.
The supposed Russian...
The rumored P-tape, yes, right. From the Steele dossier.
A blackmail
we
tool.
We did the... Matt Lubchansky and I wrote the what happened in it, basically.
So. I think it's the greatest piece of artwork the Nib has ever produced. It's amazing.
It's certainly the most... I don't know, a lowbrow piece.
People can still find it up there on the web, and it's probably not safe for work, but it's a lot of fun.
I mean,
work.
I would turn the audio low if you're at work. I would put on headphones, yeah.
But you, and so the thing about the nib, and you have been very clear about this, because you yourself have been stiffed as an artist getting your stuff thrown up on other platforms that haven't paid you. You have always believed in paying the artist and paying them a living wage for the work that they put out.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we're making anybody rich, but neither are we making them poor.
And you're not giving them 90-day, 120-day plus contracts where they have to wait 3 or 4 months to pay the rent.
No.
Yes.
No, we paid people within 30 days, and we, you know, artists retained copyright for their work, so they were free to use it elsewhere. And we were pretty good with a lot of people. I think a lot of our contributors, we have a lot of goodwill from them. People turned comics that they worked on into books. There are several nib originals that ended up being like Andy Warner, one of our also who's one of our contributing editors, did a collaboration with Sophie Louise Dam, who was working for us as an editorial assistant at the time, and she illustrated this piece on Micronations that is a book that came out this year. And they're not alone. There have been a number of those sorts of works. So I think I've seen a few nib pieces. They've not just been pieces that have been paid for, and, you know, we've done great editorial work on them. They've also been pieces that artists have used as proof of concept to turn into something else that might grow for them.
Well, Larry, I'd like to ask about an early piece of yours. It's actually an ongoing piece of yours that ran in the NIB. It's called Reported Missing, and it's a long-form investigative comic that's been compared to the series Making a Murder and Serial. One thing that really I enjoy about this is that you're using analog tools. You're using pens and watercolor, and it really, really adds an effect to the artwork of this piece. And, you know, it's not just a typical journalistic comic, investigative journalism, but it's a personal story as well. So it's many layered. Tell us about Reported Missing.
Ah, well, the story starts with a guy going missing off a yacht many years back.
This is a true story.
This is a true story. This guy called Bob was on his yacht in Tasmania, a block away from where I grew up. And in the morning, he was not on his yacht anymore, and the yacht was found listing in the water, sinking. What grew out of that was his wife was accused and then ultimately charged with his murder. His body was never found. And I went to high school with his stepdaughter, Sarah. And so the piece centers really around Sarah's version of events, like sort of answering the question for me, really, which is, what's it like to have your mum charged and convicted of murdering your dad?
And so it's interesting in that the story is not yet, you haven't gotten a conclusion to the story.
No. Well, this is what is really interesting about this piece is, so I was aware of this story for a while. And at one point, there was a little bit of news about it. This, you know, Bob went missing in 2010. So it's been a while. Matt and I were talking about different long form pieces we'd like to do that would have more time given to them. So comics journalism pieces on our website, The NIB, have tended to be under 40 panels long, but we've broken that a couple of times. Once was with Sarah Glidden, did a piece for us in 2016 that was a profile of Jill Stein, and that was where she went and followed Jill Stein, and we had a 100 panel comic in the end. But this particular piece, we were like, we want to get something that has a little bit more tooth and can have, you know, many parts to it. So it wouldn't be published in one comic. We published in a serialized format. And this came up, this story that I'd, you know, known about from for a little while in Tasmania, because you hear things, obviously, in small communities. When I first went to interview Sarah, nothing was happening with this. Her mum was in jail for 26 years. You know, I just was doing, going and asking.
She had been sentenced to 26 years, but she had only been in jail for a short amount of time.
Yes.
And this is not a family without means. They had good lawyers. They had access to, people in, a very affluent community.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, that's one of the interesting things is the way that the woman who was convicted of murder, Sue, was portrayed was as this woman, you know, in pearls, who had access to a lot of money. What she really had access to was a property, a farm property, and she had been a horse trainer, and she wore pearls to her daughter's wedding, which was the photo of her that was circulated. So that's not necessarily, you know, the way that she actually was as a person, or, you know, how much money the family actually had, which is sort of, makes it a little bit more complicated. But one thing that did change when I started working on the piece is that there was a piece of legislation passed in Tasmania that allowed for people to appeal on the basis of fresh and compelling evidence. And so for the last few years, there's been moves for, a retrial. And there was an appeal hearing in 2017 that went on until 2018. And she's just now getting her appeal. So that was not happening when we first started working on this.
And I've really gone back and forth on whether or not I think she's guilty or not.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the twists and turns, in the real life case, and as you have been spinning this comic out, you know, it really is, truth is more interesting than fiction.
I literally wrote the last chapter, like maybe a month or so before we published everything, because so many things were changing, as we went to print. Which is interesting that's in journalism, it's way easier to, go on the radio and say, "Hey guys, something's changed." You try doing that in full watercolor.
Yeah, especially the way Larry does them, where there's like, she creates patterns, if there's like a tile pattern in someone's kitchen, she's like meticulously, it's You know,
I'm crazy.
and you love to draw water, or to paint water at least.
I really do. Yeah, I do enjoy that.
I mean, you grew up around water. So, I mean, well, are there more chapters, do you think, down the line to this story? Are you?
I mean, I would love to do another chapter after this appeal hearing is done. I mean, I would like to, I would actually like to turn it into a book eventually, I think, because there's so much meat to this and there's so many different other voices that can be heard. You know, the voice that I focused on here is Sarah, but I think if I was to do more of this piece, I'd like to do interviews with, you know, some of the legal team and her sister, who's also been there the whole time, and, you know, even Sue herself. I'd really love to get an interview with Sue. I actually applied to go to the prison several times to do an interview with Sue, and I was knocked back every single time, which I was very annoyed about. But, yeah.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today with Ellery Mae Harris and Matt Boers. They're comics journalists and editors for The Nib magazine. So, Matt, you know, you have a cast of characters you like to work with.
I have
in your
a cat
comics
too. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. comics are notoriously difficult to make. I mean, especially political comics. It's too easy to just put words and pictures together to make infographics.
Mm-hmm.
When something comes along, you have your group of characters. You have your Sunday talk show pundits. You have your unlikely pals, the one in the MAGA hat, and you have the post-apocalyptic rebels, of course.
You know? Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, I never, I kind of somewhat regretted never starting a strip with like recurring characters like Tom Tomorrow Hat or something, because people seem to like that stuff, and I sort of developed these, I don't know what you would call them, soft recurring characters. Like, they don't have names. They're just like archetypes, like, you know, the MAGA guy and the Sunday talk show host. And then it kind of kicked into high gear with the post-apocalyptic stuff when we started doing the animation. And me and Matt Lubchansky, you know, we have a similar interest in, you know, science fiction, post-apocalyptic stuff. And also the vibe of the world right now is sort of heading towards
a little
that.
Dystopian.
Yeah, and especially, you know, going back a few years when it was early in Trump's presidency and it just seemed terrible. I don't know that it seems better now, but, you know. But we just started riffing on it, and, yeah, you know, the end point of kind of a lot of political cartoons just seemed like they worked really well with jumping ahead a little bit into the future. So we did a ton of animations about where Trump is sort of this Immortan Joe type figure from Mad Max, and, you know, there's various factions, there's mutants and cyborgs, of course, there's gigantic Trump robot sentinels. Like, we're mixing together, you know, Days of Future Past, Mad Max, just basically everything, Terminator, throwing it in. There's time travelers, and then there's like the Democratic Resistance, which is the underground resistance trying to defeat Trump in his, you know, eighth election, and, you know, trying to think of a new catchphrase to get the centrists on board with them, you know, and just failing.
Well, the humor and mockery, I mean, this is something that goes back to, even before daily newspapers were a thing, it goes back to the 18th century to the great British cartoonists who were absolutely brutal at mocking the nobles and the lords, and you know, this has, I mean, governments have been taken down. Famously, the Boss Tweed group in New York was taken down 100 and some years ago by cartoonists. And humor and mockery is, it just seems like this is the province. Cartoonists don't get their due for the great service that they give to society.
Well, that's what I say. You know, I can't believe that Trump himself is not condemning us daily. But, you know, you really have to, you'd have to be on TV for him to know or care. I have to get denounced by Fox News, essentially. If Fox and Friends picks up on a cartoon I do and says it's, you know,
it's gold,
too
huh?
radical or anti-fascist and therefore fascist or something, and he sees it while he's, you know, during his 6 hours of morning executive time, then he'll tweet about a cartoonist.
But so are you going to bribe somebody to slip one of your cartoons into his morning briefing then?
Yeah. well, I don't know. I don't know who. I don't have any contacts in the White House right now, but, you know, I mean, I'd love to be I'd love Trump to read the...
If you're listening and you work for Donald Trump,
yes,
Matt Balls wants you to show him some of his cartoons, please.
If you're Donald Trump and you're listening to KBOO Words and Pictures for some reason, you just found a link on Twitter. I would love to know what he thinks of the waste. We call them the wasteland comics,
the
post-apocalyptic
comics.
Stuff. Yeah.
Well, Larry just showed me a page from the Scams issue. Tell me about this.
We have the original Boss Tweed Busted cartoon with a lovely blurb from Jenny E. Robb, a curator at the Billy Island Museum and Library, which is a comics library in Ohio. I've just dropped some.
Lost some stickers.
Yeah.
And you can have these stickers, by the way. if you're interested in getting this copy of the Scams issue, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
All right. But anyway, sorry. Let's talk about the Billy Ireland Museum, because you're good friends with the folks there, and one of the things that NIB does is they publish old cartoons from the collection there. It's sort of plus change, plus the même chose. Old stuff, old topics come around again. Everything kind of stays the same.
Yeah, we've had the great privilege over many years, since Medium days, of working with the curators at the Billy Island Library to sort of gather together cartoons of a bygone era that are either completely insane and irrelevant and therefore hilarious, or cartoons that are usually, and this is more what we do, cartoons that are sadly still very relevant, which is... There are comics from, the 1800s about gun control reforms, mm-hmm. that are sadly very relevant now.
Oh, yeah, and particularly anything about immigration. Same arguments have been made over and over. And a lot of the old cartoonists were incredibly racist or misogynist and everything else, too. I mean, sometimes we'll run something like that just to show, like look how, terrible these arguments used to be. So we'll often run stuff that's mocking those types of views, but I think we've run a couple cartoons that are objectively terrible in their day, but just to kind of show how the arguments used then were the same that people are using now.
It used to be the end of the 20th century was sort of considered the golden age of editorial cartooning. You had amazing people like Herblock and Oliphant and all these amazing people who were making really good living. Jack Oman talks about when he started out at the age of 19, he sold a cartoon to Time magazine and bought his first car. It was a used car, but still. And Matt,
I've had a different experience.
Jack Oman has since moved on. He used to be the Oregonian cartoonist. Oregonian is no longer interested in political cartoons, apparently, so he moved down to Sacramento. But he used to bring together these conventions of political cartoonists here in Portland, and there would be fewer and fewer each year. They're really an endangered species, and the ones who are actually saying things that are controversial, who are not just doing, Thanksgiving turkey cartoons every year, the ones who are controversial, their jobs are on the line now.
Yeah, well, I would even say that they don't have jobs. I mean, I know Jack pretty well. He's a good friend, and I've been part of the AAC, which is the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. And in fact, their convention next month is going to overlap with CXC, which is Columbus Crossroads, which is a small press convention put on by, in association with the Billy Ireland. And they're doing a kind of night of NIB programming. So I want to give them a shout out. But yeah, the staff job thing, doesn't really exist at all. I would argue that many of the best political cartoonists right now are being published on the NIB, but for them, it's a regular freelance gig. I mean, there's not a lot of other places that are running them, and there's certainly not a full-time job available.
One of the things that we've really done at the NIB is tried to foster the artwork of young artists who might have been editorial cartoonists in another world, particularly cartoonists who are people of color and female. We've published a lot of work by artists like that. And worked with people, you know, Matt and Matt Lubchansky have used their giant joke brains to assist in taking an idea and sort of pushing it a little bit further. Like, that's one of the benefits of having editors who know a lot about comics, is like people are able to show us an idea and we can punch it up.
Well, yeah, artists are being told these days, you know, right as they're in art school, that if they want to make a living, they no longer have the right to just do their art. They have to learn how to be outreach coordinators, website builders, social media promoters, financial managers. And you two have been helping with that process for a lot of up-and-coming youngsters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want the NIB to be a place that's publishing established pros, you know, like Jen Sorensen and Tom Tomorrow, and also new people coming up. Like, we publish... Two people in particular, two women, Karis JB and Chelsea Saunders, who are both young women and women of color, which is, you know, pretty remarkable in editorial cartooning, which is mostly white guys. And they both won the Locor Award, which is given out to young political cartoonists every year by the Locor family, Dick Locor. The old Dick Tracy artist and editorial cartoonist.
Well, I met him a couple times when I lived in Chicago. He was, you know, and he was not a, you know, he's not a liberal guy either.
No,
but he was a really solid character. He was a really really great guy. Very appreciative of youngsters and new talent.
But point is that, you know, there's not really that many people up and coming anyway. That there are, you know, that you can give awards to. And the last 2 years, it's been people from the NIB. I mean, I wish I could say, you know, we weren't the only outlet that was publishing stuff like this, but a lot of mainstream places don't have, they, you know, they don't run any cartoons by anyone. Like, it used to be pretty normal for dailies to employ a staff cartoonist or even just run syndicated stuff if they didn't want it or couldn't afford a staff cartoonist. And that really didn't translate to the web a lot. I mean, there's places that do run comics for sure, but, you know, a lot of places, very well-funded, well-staffed, you know, places like, I don't know, Huffington Post, to name one, let's say. I mean, it doesn't even seem to be on the radar. That's partly why the NIB exists, you know, is to try to, I wanted to make a home for this type of cartooning and other related, like, nonfiction and journalistic comics, because they're not really given that much space elsewhere in media.
And also, I mean, you have an international reach. And Larry, you, like Matt, are a globetrotter. You grew up in a Commonwealth country. It seems like editorial cartooning is still pretty vital in other countries, in Britain, in France, overseas. I mean, what's your opinion of that?
Well, when I was being published by the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, that was as a fill-in person for the holidays when Kathy Wilcox and other cartoonists were, you know, Kathy Wilcox is a great Australian cartoonist. Everyone should look her up. She's incredible. But when I left and came here to work full-time on the NIB, they did not hire a holiday fill-in person. There is no holiday fill-in person. So there is no... I mean, I think Australian publications are collapsing. You know, there's not really a bunch of spaces being made for new Australian cartoonists either. I think that the problems that the US media faces are fairly international, you know? Like, they definitely are spaces for cartoonists in different newspapers across the world. I would never say that there aren't. But I think that the issues that... The problem of new media, the problem that has been... The big issue with our whole careers is still very present the world over. I don't think we've solved it.
And famously, the New York Times International Edition decided not to continue running editorial cartoons. And, people blame the internet, but it really is just people trying to avoid controversy as much as possible.
Well, that one, yeah, definitely seemed editors trying to avoid conflict that came from another illustration that someone else did. So it was
really
ridiculous.
Weird.
But, and you know, Mad Magazine is ending operations.
So
and then
sad.
Just other non-comics publications in media are contracting, laying off people, shutting down all the time. So.
And the strange thing is that people will say the first thing they turn to in the newspaper, if they still get the newspaper, is the comics or the editorial cartoon, the first thing they look at.
Yeah, I mean, we run a comics website, and they seem to be very popular. People, you know, say that getting the daily newsletter with political cartoons in it is the first thing they read and the thing that gets them through this, you know, hellish daily news cycle that we live in.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we've been talking with Matt Boris and Larry May Harris, comics journalists and editors for the Nib magazine. Matt and Larry, how can our listeners find out more about the Nib?
Well, just go to thenib.com. You can sign up for the daily newsletter, and if you're interested in supporting us, we are now 100% member supported. We lost our corporate funding last month, or, you know, at the turn of this month, and we're still going to keep going. I'm resuming publishing next week, but the only way to keep it going is if people sign up and get our magazine and support our daily newsletter.
If you love comics, buy the Nib.
Thank you both for joining us today. And many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at kboo.fm. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil on Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, Cuba's oil supply was cut by more than half. This film tells of the hardships and struggles, as well as the community and creativity of the Cuban people during this transition away from a highly mechanized agricultural system to one using organic methods of farming and local urban gardens. Again, that's How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.